This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the Morning Run, 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 4th of January, 2017. I'm Melissa Idris and I've got Sherrod Gooden here with me. Hello, Sherrod.
Hello.
Hello. You went one register higher. All right.
One octave. I'm like Mariah Carey. I've got
course,
at least...
multi-octave range you have. Sherrod Kutin there.
Oh, yes. So,
all right. Yeah, so stay with us this morning all the way till 10 o'clock because we've got a great show ready for you. The next 4 hours will be filled with news and analysis and interviews as well. For example, on The Breakfast Grill today, we have the Business Integrity Alliance, the BIA, which was recently set up to identify and eliminate corruption through engagement with the business community in Malaysia. So we've got the CEO, Dr. Mark Lovett, BIA CEO, that is, as well as a member of the Alliance. Top Glove's Managing Director, Lee Kim Miao, will be on The Breakfast Grill with you, Sherrod, to discuss integrity and ethics in business.
Yeah, it's an interesting, dilemma, I think, because when I think of business, I think of, hardened individuals with the profit motive, upmost in their minds and the bottom line. And I think the argument that's being made is that the bottom line is affected by corrupt practices and that at an enterprise level, at least, much can be done to improve the performance and the advantages of a company vis-a-vis its rivals if it does, in fact, stay away from corrupt practices. It's not something I think of as a persuasive argument intuitively, I think, but it's an argument that's being made, and I think these two gentlemen make it quite well.
Well, I remember reading news of the launch of this Business Integrity Alliance just a few months ago, and I remember being, skeptical, to say the least, because I think they had just a few members at that point.
Well, they have four.
Four, that's right. So I was thinking, how much of a difference can they make?
Except that Mark Lovett's own company, which kind of promotes, the kind of practices and teaches organizations how to avoid corruption, it's also one of the members. And that's not a serious... it's not a big industry. Top Glove is huge, right?
Yes, that's right. It's a global industry. Yeah. And I think what they want to do is show that they have zero tolerance for, malpractice.
Or, yeah. And I think, the other thing that's happening with them is they're making the argument that it doesn't matter. They don't need to have the numbers. What they do have to do is have crucial players in the Malaysian economic ecosystem. So if you have, say, for instance, GLCs on board, because they're linked to so many other companies and so many other companies are plugged into them, that if they take the steps, if they put in processes, that's going to have a knock-on effect throughout the economy. And so I think that's what their game plan for the coming years is to fact, get those government-linked companies on board as much as they're doing the, private enterprises and the big ones like Top Glove. Mm. So it's an interesting, program, considering that we talk about corruption and there's so much rhetoric against corruption, in this country, but we're also constantly faced with, just the front pages to this morning's paper, Melissa, we have there Sina Harian, we have, senior member of the MACC has quit out of disappointment. Now, on other papers, we see, like if you take the NSD, for instance, they run a story about corruption, but I had still to find the story of, Bahri Mohamad Zain's, resignation in their pages. So they're talking about graft, but they...
Kind of graft? Because the headline reads, lust and graft.
Absolutely.
So that sounds like a really seedy paperback novel to me.
Yeah. So it's talking about particular things. And I think this is very important, right? How, it could be like these lavish dinners. It could be like these holidays overseas that are sponsored.
Right. Okay.
I mean, that's one way of influencing, decision-making in procurement, for instance, or trading sex for these kinds of things. But the more important thing is that, okay, so that's their main story. But where is the story of
Dato' Bahri Mat Zain, who was the I believe and this part is of the MACC.
Yeah. So again, this always comes back, you know, to the question of whether, you know, in Malaysia we're being selective, you know, in our coverage. You know, there's a lot of highfalutin talk and rhetoric, but is it matched by and by people perhaps who themselves are extraordinarily corrupt? And this is something you recently had that Finnish anti-corruption police chief,
right,
who was taken in for corruption.
So can I mean, with corruption, there has to be collusion at every level, right? So there has to be a supply and demand. So this is targeting the corporate sector, so the private sector. So this BIA is targeting the private sector from naughty practices in business, say offering a bribe to the public sector to secure a contract or procurement.
Not necessarily. I mean, could the procurement, you know, process happens between private enterprises too, right? So, if you're a company and you need to get some raw materials for your product, your procurement officer might be taking the bid that is benefiting his or her, you know, pocket rather than the one that's benefiting the enterprise.
So, what's the incentive of joining this alliance? I mean, is it purely, you know, being able to say, look, I'm a member of the Business Integrity Alliance and reassuring your stakeholders?
Well, that's one thing. I think that it's also some of the arguments that I made that are quite persuasive is that when, in fact, collective action is taken, then there cannot be victimization. So for you, instance, if you are a single enterprise and you go against the system and you whistleblow or you kind of alert authorities, you might actually end up being on the receiving end of a very short stick, right? Because you're kind of stepping out of line. But once there's some sort of collective voice coming from private enterprise, I think the idea is that then no individual enterprise could be victimized. Mm-hmm. So I think those are some of the arguments that are marshaled in order to make sense of this. Otherwise, it would just be this kind of a facile symbolic gesture,
right,
that seems to be made all
the
time.
It's a club that they go and have cigars and drinks.
You know, we see this all the time. I mean, at one point, everybody, disdained the green movement. Now everybody's green. Even the most polluting, offenders of the environment also talk about going green. And so it becomes, you know, the kind of ways in which these home truths and important messages are taken up, not not because somebody truly believes in them, only to in fact evade the reality. So I think that's something that's not happening, at least not now, with this particular alliance.
Well, I look forward to it. The Business Integrity Alliance, we're going to discuss that on The Breakfast Grill with the CEO of the alliance and a member, Top Glove's Managing Director. So make sure you stay tuned for The Breakfast Grill in a couple of hours. After The Grill, we're going to be looking at the environment, as you mentioned, Sharad, the importance of governance and also the environment. Now, Malaysia and Indonesia, as you know, are top two producers of crude palm oil in the world, and most of our plantations are on the island of Borneo. So today on Current Affairs, we're going to look at the impact of the rapid deforestation in the island of Borneo and how that's affecting climate change around the world.
You know, this has been a devastating, well, the last century was devastating for the environment. I mean, and we're going into this century with news that, you know, in a couple of decades, the number of species that are going to be completely extinct are extraordinary.
Can I give you some numbers? Malaysia has lost about 4.2 million hectares of forests since 1973 in Borneo, that is.
So that would be Sabah, Sarawak.
That's right. So that's about 30% of our original forest cover back then. And out of that 30%, more than half of it has been used for palm oil plantations and pulpwood plantations as well.
Yeah, it's
that's a staggering amount to know that we've lost a third over the last four decades.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at different parts of the world, I mean, you're going to have that, you know, it's urbanization, it's increased human populations that, you know, demanding more land and such. And, you know, it's just that. So the question is whether these kinds of problems can be solved at a national level, right? Because you can't in some ways deny the rights or the desires of the people of those nations to develop, and they need space too. But because forests are a global heritage and their benefits to the environment are global in nature, not purely in the nation-state kind of terms or framework, then how do you solve the problem? In some ways, you know, that's what I think the initiatives kind of recognize. I mean, you know, you need to, it has to be collective responsibility. And, you know, the world in some ways has to pay, you know, different nation states to protect their our global heritage, right?
And we're going to be continuing this theme, a theme looking at environmental, social and corporate governance, or better known as ESG, and how you can invest in ESG classified stocks with Chris Eng on the S&M show. Chris is from Etica Insurance in Takaful, and he's going to be discussing what the criteria are for a stock to be classified ESG and to look at some of the returns in comparison with the non-ESG investments. So interesting, yeah. So let's take a quick look, Sharad. It's 6:11 right now. Take a quick look at the news as we start our day. Yesterday was the first day of the new Congress in the US, and it was already messy, shall we say. They had initially, in a surprise move, proposed to strip the powers of the Office of Congressional Ethics of its independence. The OEC, of course, is the watchdog that was set up back in 2008 after a series of scandals on Capitol Hill. But suddenly they reversed this decision because President-elect Donald Trump had criticized the move on Twitter. He had tweeted, "Focus on tax reform, healthcare, and so many other things of far greater importance." So he chided Republicans on Twitter, and they reversed this decision. There you go. First day of Congress.
Well, Twitter is going to be such an extraordinary platform.
He's going to govern through Twitter, I tell you.
But what if Twitter doesn't get its act together and they tank? Then what is he going to do? He's going to use Facebook?
Facebook updates. There you go. And speaking about Trump and Twitter, he again on Twitter chided North Korea and China in two separate Twitter posts. But then again, Beijing has shrugged off that criticism. This was over curbing North Korea's weapons program. So just some background here. In his first tweet, Donald Trump remarked that there was news over the weekend that North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un said his government was completing preparations for a test launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile, and that could be the next stage in developing a nuclear weapon, which could strike parts of the US.
Trump, so how much said, can he no. put in a 140-character tweet?
I tell you what he said? Hmm. It won't happen. It won't happen. North Korea says that it's in the final stages of developing a nuclear weapon. It won't happen, according to Donald Trump.
So I don't know when we're going to tire of mocking the president-elect for his statements, because, again, it's not exactly nuanced, but I think his underlings then carry on the business of clarifying what he means.
Could I ask you if you think he himself tweets, or there's someone who's got, you know, the guardians of his Twitter?
I don't know. That's a very interesting question. The syntax is remarkably consistent. Yeah. I mean, it consists of
the tone, yeah.
It's like, don't do that. Yes, good. Bad boy. Bad men. Good men. I mean, he has the vocabulary of a 12-year-old, American teenager. And, you know, and so I do. But again, you know, at some point, we will tire of ourselves criticizing Donald Trump for conducting, you know, presidential business in this fashion, especially, I mean, who would care except that America is a global superpower?
Do you think it influences policy? I mean,
clearly.
Yeah, so I think no matter what he says, no matter what platform he says, be it an interview on TV or, you know, 140 characters on Twitter, it will impact policy making or relate, international relations, it will make the news. So I don't think we'll ever get, you know, past Donald Trump's Twitter feed if he continues on this.
So what is missing? What is it that you could go missing in this? Is you know, he could issue commands on Twitter, but can you persuade people? Can you have reasoned debate on Twitter such?
Our IGP issues commands on Twitter, so
well,
clearly
there you have it.
Yeah,
proof.
Proof that it happens around the world. 6:15 right now. We'll be back with more news and discussion after this on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Mercy, Mercy Me by Marvin Gaye there. Hello and good morning, 6:21 right now. You're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, also Sharad Kutin. Now, over the weekend, on New Year's Eve, Mariah Carey had a very public meltdown on stage while performing for Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve with Ryan Seacrest. She was the final act before the ball dropped at midnight, and I'm sure you must have heard this by now, that she experienced some technical difficulties while on stage and through what media reports have called a royal tantrum, because she was upset that her in-ear microphone, her in-ear, shall we say?
Earplug,
kind of was not...
Well, not earplug. Earplug suggests...
In-ear monitor, was not working and she couldn't hear herself. So she didn't sing and, you know, made sarcastic comments on stage. So I guess...
In fact, I think she went on to accuse the organizers of sabotaging her.
Yes,
and they came out and said that it was ridiculous that they would do that. Why would they? And then they went on to list her failures, including not turning up for a rehearsal. She, you know, she had sent a
substitute to check on it.
Yeah, and, you know, so a range of things, you know, suggesting that she was not being professional herself.
Okay. Well, what this triggered was, in fact, a discussion about when we humble, ordinary folk, non-celebrity Hollywood folk, are giving a live performance, you know, be it, you know, in front of your boss or in front of clients, and you experience technical difficulties. There's nothing worse than experiencing a tech breakdown in the middle of a live performance.
Yeah, I wonder if, you know, maybe what you mean when you say live performance,
well,
you mean
in front of an audience,
like
in front of an audience,
like a presentation to your boss and all.
Well,
that,
you know, if I'm sure you've had experiences where your computer froze or that video wouldn't play or you couldn't get the PowerPoint to load or the, you know, the alignment messes got messed up or something. I'm sure you faced that, and at the moment you can. I faced that, and I remember thinking to myself, oh no, you know, all the hard work that's gone into this preparation, you can feel the cold sweat trickle down your back.
There's a lot of pressure. And I mean, you know, we played a track from Marvin Gaye just now, and, you know, yesterday I had, I was, you know, watching Marvin Gaye in concert in Montreux, and it was...
In person? On TV?
TV, yeah, I mean, last night. And, you know, and because he's been dead for about three decades.
You said I've been watching Marvin Gaye in concert.
I was watching him in concert because he was on TV. It was a recorded thing. But, you know, and it made me go back and look up the details of his death. Because I remember his death and, you know, at the hands of his father. His father shot him. And what led to it. But the one thing I discovered, because it was, you know, like I said, it was 30 years ago. It was the fact that tours and touring and the pressure of touring really was something he didn't like and couldn't cope with. And so, you know, he turned to drugs. And so one of his main problems was his drug addiction as a consequence of the pressure he felt from, you know, these live performances he did. I mean, and he was extraordinary to watch. I mean, I don't know if you like Marvin Gaye's music.
I do.
You did, and, you know, as a performer, I mean, you know, he was really quite, I mean, the complexity of the musical arrangements he did, you know, or one song flowing into another, you know, and then the big band with the horns and everything. It was just extraordinary. So you can imagine it's not just his performance, him singing, but the whole band, everything needing to come together, the backup singers, the horn section, the, you know, whatever it is, the drums, and all that conducted in a way that would deliver a great performance. Because people pay good money to go to these performances, and so there's a lot of pressure on them.
When something goes wrong in a live performance, what do you do? Even if you're not, you know, a big star performer,
well, I think having a sense of humor is good.
Do you admit to the problem?
Yeah, well, I think clearly, you know, if it's a problem, it's going to be showing, right? I mean, the only problem that really matters is the one that shows. I mean, well, the audience is affected.
You won't know it, though. But
no, if your sound goes down, if your overhead projector doesn't show, I mean, then because everybody knows that something's
up.
Well,
more often than not, the audience doesn't know what you've planned, right? So if you wing it, if you kind of smooth and gloss over it, they might even think that's part of your presentation or your performance.
Yeah, so if it's not something that's obvious, the lights don't come on, or the sound doesn't come on, or it doesn't come on cue, then of course you can, if you have presence of mind, you could save the situation just by, as you put it, winging it, I think. I think having a sense of humor and having the audience on your side is important. Throwing a hissy fit and a tantrum generally isn't very helpful.
Yeah,
I agree. Great for the tabloids the next day. I mean, because if you're talking about celebrities, you're talking about just ordinary people. I think losing your cool then becomes the performance.
And
then,
that's right.
Then you become the spectacle rather than what you were trying to project. And so maybe, then you get judged for your ability to operate under pressure, or your inability to operate under pressure. And I think that's probably more damning at the end of the day, isn't it?
Yeah. What you said, the presence of mind to kind of keep your cool when something goes wrong. Clearly, Mariah Carey didn't decide that getting the audience on her side was important, you know, addressing this with a measure of humor and grace. But what she did do, in fact, was get the audience to sing, and then she made some really sarcastic remarks about, oh, that was wonderful, that was amazing, isn't this all amazing? And I wonder, again, just looking at this story, whether this was specific to her and Mariah Carey's diva culture that she has helped perpetuate in Hollywood and celebritydom, whether that's part of, you know, being a diva, that you must, everything must go according to my wants and wishes.
Okay, let's assume that the kind of celebrity culture is, a slightly different creature, right? Because of the high intensity sort of spotlight on those individuals. But even in, like you say, in ordinary life, you have it. I mean, say for instance, something goes wrong at a restaurant, and then you watch, you know, waiters and their managers, you know, belt it out or kind of shout at each other, and you think, was this really necessary? Yeah. You know, why would they not take this to a quiet place and not, you know, involve us all in, you know, whatever management strife they have? And I think sometimes, you know, losing your cool, not being able to, take something out of the, you know, out of the spectacle, out of the spotlight, and kind of deal with it is also a failure, isn't it? I mean, you ever get troubled by this when people don't know how to contain their anger at a failure and, you know, feel the need to... And this is the other thing, because, you know... embarrassing the other person who has failed sometimes is a way that other people recoup their own reputation.
Yeah, yeah. So managing that.
Yeah.
Right?
So it's just like, well, you know, I'm such a great manager because I've now shown this person who works under me to be a complete fool and incompetent, right? And so that becomes the show. The show becomes a display of. But I don't know. That's not something I buy. I wouldn't buy, you know, front row tickets to a manager who needs to embarrass his or her underlings in order to shore up their own sense of, you know, responsibility or, you know, capacity. I think that's kind of poor,
Yeah, no, I do agree with you. I think that in daily life, that's not something I would condone, or I think I would take a private word with the person and say, you know, you really didn't need to do that.
So somebody should have taken Mariah Carey aside.
But who would? Again, because she feels that she's above and entitled to it. And by putting down the organizers and by yelling at the organizers, making a spectacle on stage, she was then punishing the organizers.
Okay, can you imagine if she married that billionaire, if that went through?
James Packer.
I think Carrie Packer's son. You know, then she would have been a double diva because she would have been yeah. like, she's a billionaire. And is she a billionaire? She must be a multimillionaire.
She must be.
And then she's married to a billionaire. That would be a lethal combination.
All that power and money. Okay, 6:30 right now.
And looks.
Time for the news bulletin on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Sweet Home Alabama by Lynyrd Skynyrd. Hello and good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. It's now 6:41 on Wednesday, the 4th of January, 2017. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Sharad Kutan here with me. And speaking about the first few days of 2017, Sharad, there's already the first meme of 2017 has come out.
Yeah, it's not unexpected. I mean, memes, emerged.
So quickly.
Well, I think, you know, we've gotten very excited by the meme because memes are often global in nature. I don't know if the one that we're going to be talking about is global in nature, but often memes have that, you know, capacity across cultures. At least, well, you know, those who are to share those platforms, right, to the extent that those are cultural boundaries there. But also because it really is a sign of the times, right? Things that get people excited, you know, why would one music video hit billions of, you know, get billions of hits on YouTube and something not? And I think it's a real insight into the hearts and minds of people.
Okay, so the meme we're talking about is Robbie Williams using some hand sanitizer during New Year's Eve performance, and that's become the first meme of 2017. So what happened was Robbie Williams was singing "Auld Lang Syne," and he had held hands or shook hands with members of the audience. And the whole time he looked really uncomfortable. So when he finally pulled away, he went straight back to the backstage to put antibacterial hand wash on his hands. And the cameras caught it. And late to cut. So he had a look on his face that people caught and it went viral.
So, okay, so the look of embarrassment, being caught.
Grimacing was the look, yeah.
And grimacing at the cameras for catching him.
Grimacing at the notion of having to touch someone else and then the need to put hand sanitizer. So I think he was grimacing at the germs he felt was on his hands.
Well, the truth is, you do, get germs on you when you touch other people. I mean, you know, there are all these really bizarre things we do, like, you know, pinch the cheeks of babies and stuff. And apparently babies...
Because they're so cute.
Yeah, but, you know, we are transferring the germs from...
I will pinch your cheeks, too, and wash my hands with hand sanitizer.
I think you mean my jowls. You know, no, it's actually because, you know, I've lost my cheeks. what were once cheeks have now drooped into jowls. No, I mean, but seriously, because I don't have jowls, is that, you know, you transfer germs. And, you know, people who have public engagements and do have to shake a lot of hands actually run serious risks to their health when they do that, I think. And I think that's why the hands...
Politicians who have to shake a lot of hands and kiss a lot of babies, right?
Well, they should, again, back to the babies. I don't think they should be kissing the babies. I think they should lay off the poor children. I mean,
no,
you know,
it's a great photo op, Sharad. You know, holding a baby. The most popular photos of Obama in his administration had to do with him interacting with children.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that aside, and the fact that children are petri dishes and you might actually pick something up from them, is the other side of the issue, which is why everybody's so aghast that somebody would use hand sanitizer, you know, and why celebrities or politicians. And I remember years ago, you know, in Singapore, there was a politician who was caught out for doing something really odd. I mean, I can't remember the gender of the person, but, you know, was at a market, shook hands with various people, including a fishmonger, and immediately kind of washed their hands. So the fishmonger, obviously dealing with fish, had, you know, fishy stuff on his hands.
You don't think that's insulting to the fishmonger?
Well, this is it, right? I think we grow up with this idea that that is insulting, when I think it's just a practical question.
Okay, can I confess a personal anecdote? I have sweaty palms, and often when it's out of my control, right? So I sometimes, before I shake hands with people, often use hand sanitizer because the alcohol evaporates whatever sweaty palms I might have. I have been in a situation before where I've just shaken somebody's hand and seen them wipe it down their pants side. And I was really embarrassed, but also a little insulted.
But hold on. I mean, why would you be insulted?
Why could he have waited? At least wait till I turn around, then wipe your hands.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, you realize it was your fault.
You have sweaty hands. It's not something I can control.
Well, if your hands are dirty and you know, somebody else
would
responds.
Would you rather I didn't shake? So someone came up to me and said, oh, sorry, I can't shake your hand because I got sweaty palms. I mean, isn't that more insulting
Don't you, in a situation where you've just come from, say, the toilet and you just wash your hands, hands are wet or not completely dry, and you know somebody offers their hands in greeting and you say, well, I'm sorry, my hands are wet, right? And it's perfectly reasonable not to, I mean, maybe you don't want to say I have sweaty palms. You could say, which sounds like you have some sort of condition, but you could say something like, you know, you do have a condition.
Sweat glands, we all have them.
Yeah, but you know, you obviously have an excessive amount of sweat glands. But let's not go into this. You know, I mean, you can always offer, you know, that's why, and there are all kinds of greetings also. And I think maybe we don't have as much of a repertoire of greetings as we could have. For instance, you could Y in the Thai style, put hands clasped together and you just, you know, Y somebody, you know, or namaste somebody in the Indian form, which is exactly the same thing as a Y.
Okay, all right. So that would eliminate the need for me to touch that person.
Because touch actually does transfer germs. And I think, you know, for me, you know, in the age of, you know, germ warfare, I think it's perfectly reasonable for people to clean themselves. And I think especially public personalities that have to do, maybe the kind of expression that he had maybe is the one that was misread or read in particular ways that was problematic. So this is kind of icky. Like, you know, big smiles when you're shaking hands with a fishmonger. As soon as you turn your back to them, you kind of, you know, roll your eyes.
Right, the insincerity of the moment.
So I think that's where it's at, right? That's why it probably goes viral, because the feeling that the emotions that you express are not your true emotions, and you know, and the hand washing or cleaning is an instance, evidence of your lack of sincerity. But why would you even believe that, you know, a singer loves you in a crowd of 10,000 people?
So why do you think it's become a meme? Why do you think people are fixated on this image of insincerity? It may be insincere, it may be, but why do you think that this has resonated with so many people? You think about the most popular memes, you know, I'm sure you've come across memes like Good Guy Greg. Have you come across Good Guy Greg? Greg is a good guy. He's, you know, ignored some. The young ones will know what I'm talking about. And memes like the ridiculously good-looking guy who is running a marathon, but he looks fantastically photogenic in this meme. So, you know, those are some of the memes that have gone viral. And I'm not sure why it's gone viral, but I guess it's because it's humorous or we can relate to it in a kind of sociocultural kind of way. But with this, with Robbie Williams, I don't know why it has won the award of the first meme of 2017.
Well, you know, there's also this whole kind of machismo around Robbie Williams, and maybe in that instance he was, you know, kind of acting a little kind of prissy with the hand cream. I just watched it and I thought, okay. Who knows what people, you know, you know, and often I think the emotions that people have result in them sharing something like a video that creates memes is fleeting. So, you know, we dwell on it, the media dwells on it, you know, it fixes it in time, whereas for most people it was a 2-second thought, you know, like, oh, this is funny, you know, press share.
Sure.
So I'm not quite sure if, you know, it deserves all the attention. But I do think we should stop, you know, expecting too much of celebrities and politicians. I mean, especially in this, that they feel sincerely for us or they truly believe in
so
what they say.
So expect the worst, is it?
No, I don't think it's not about expecting the worst, but I think it's putting those expectations in context. I mean, you know, when a singer says, I love you, don't take it personally.
If you met your idol, let's say you met someone you've really, you know, who's made an influence in your life, you book or song or movie or whatever.
I met Ben Kingsley once.
Okay, and you said, can I give you a hug because you changed my life? And
no, actually what I wanted to do is get down on my knees and clasp my hands over my head and say, Gandhiji, but of course I didn't because what he said to us, me and this other person carrying film at the festival, he said, are you going up? And she said, no, we're going down. And then he just let the elevator close.
Oh, what a
and I was struck dumb. I was mute, you know.
What a missed opportunity. You could have ridden the elevator with Ben Kingsley. Sir Ben Kingsley.
Yeah. He was not in Gandhi at that point. He was already past Gandhi fame. He did something called...
Once in Gandhi, forever in Gandhi.
The movie was called The Children. It was a brilliant, brilliant movie.
Okay. So if he refused to hug you, would you feel slighted?
I would never You'd ask be to like, hug.
Sir Ben, you've changed my life with
if
the movie
If he refused
Gandhi.
To shake my hand, I might be a bit insulted, but you know.
Maybe use some hand sanitizer after.
Like throw myself at Ben Kingsley. Like, I want to hug you. Don't be silly.
6:51 right now. We've got Blondie with Maria on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.